Public Affairs Committee to order, and the first item on our agenda is going to be a work session on SJR 7. And I'd like a motion to move SJR 7 without recommendation to the House Judiciary Civil Law Committee.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. And the work session on SJR 7 is closed, and open a work session on Senate Bill 961. And I would appreciate a motion to move Senate Bill 961 to the House Judiciary Civil Law Committee without recommendation.
So moved.
So the motion, colleagues, to move the bill to civil. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And that piece of business is taken care of. Thank you. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1207. And we have some amendments before us today. Actually, we had one other piece of work to do, a reconsideration on 2830. We need to wait until it's been posted for an hour to do that, take it back into our possession. Let's do that, too, while we're here. There are dash six amendments for House Bill 2830, and if we pull that back into committee, we can stick those in. They aren't ready yet, and we need to get it back into our possession to avoid timeline problems with between the time that we drop the bill, we vote the bill out, and then it gets off at the clerk's desk. So, I'd like to just pull it back into our possession. Reconsider the vote by which we pass the bill. Chair, I'll open a session on the House Bill 2830.
Go ahead.
We need a suspension of the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote.
Mr. Chair, I move for a suspension of the rules to reconsider the purpose of which we reconsider the vote on the Senate Bill, or House Bill 2830.
Okay. Thank you very much. I have a motion, colleagues, to reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2830. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Mr. Beyer?
Got a question. What time did you post this agenda?
An hour ago.
Well, it says in your agenda you have to wait across the 3:30 to hear these bills.
We're told by the clerk we don't have any problems in case we're
not taking final disposition action on the bills in the moment that we could proceed.
Great.
You want to make the motion?
Certainly. I'd like to. We reconsider the vote for which we passed out House Bill 2830.
Okay. I'll give a motion before us to reconsider the vote for which we passed out House Bill 2830. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, ordered, and the bill is back in our possession, and we will have a work session when the amendments are ready. Propose a work session on House Bill 2830, and you can have the bill booked here. Mr. Moore? And we'll go back to Senate Bill 1207. And we open the work session, and we have the amendments should be in our packet. So the A4 amendments, and I'd like to ask Kelly Taylor from ODOT to come forward and give us the genesis of these A4 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. The A4 amendments come to you from our Assistant Attorney General and our review looking at Senate Bill 1207A. They are technical amendments to clarify that it's not just someone who's driving privileges that would imply someone who had a license, but maybe someone who does not, maybe someone who was convicted and had either had an out-of-state license or no license at all. Then it starts including the words or right to apply. It implies so it'll cover anyone who had a license in Oregon or did not would fall under these sanctions.
I think we should stop just for a moment.
Sure.
And, since we haven't heard this bill previously,
would you like a little history?
We need some history. And this is an issue I have dealt with some constituent colleagues who've been caught in a situation of having a third 5 years of suspension, having to serve several more years of driver's license suspension because of the way this law was drafted in the past in 1995. But let's have some background, if you would.
Mr. Chair and members. In the 95 session, it was House Bill 3060 that set the current sanctions. By the way, I'm going to hand out my testimony because part of this is in there, so excuse me just a moment. House Bill 3060 set the driver's license revocation period for persons convicted of the more serious crimes, murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide, assault, involving a motor vehicle, at 8 years. Before that, it had been 5 years, a five-year revocation. And the other thing that 3060 did was it said if the person was incarcerated, then the revocation was to begin when they got out of prison. In other words, rather than us revoking their privileges while they're in prison and not even trying to drive, okay, to wait until they got out of prison and then have them notice the fact that they lost their driving privileges. That was kind of the main theory behind 3060. But there was a retroactivity piece in a footnote of that bill that is causing the problems that Representative Simmons was mentioning, and that is, it said, this. And by the way, this bill took effect on September 9th, 1995. That's a real pivotal date. It said anyone who was in prison or on parole or post-prison supervision or probation, in other words, if you were anywhere, if you've been convicted on or after or even before, if you were anywhere within the correction system on 9995, this 8-year revocation was to hit you, and it was to start beginning with the effective date of the bill. So some people had already had their 5-year revocation and had been reinstated and was, you know, doing a productive life. I know the constituent of Representative Simmons, I looked at that record, and they had had their license back for some time. But because they were still technically within the correction system, somewhere within those four categories, that retroactivity piece went back and snagged them. In fact, it snagged a lot of people. And so what 1207 is doing, trying to do, is go back and make it more equitable. It's trying to say, you know, if you had your privileges back before 9995, King's X, you keep them, nothing else happens to you. If you were in prison on that date, you will have 8 years when you get out. It's trying to set some of that straight and not go back and snag everybody a second time, especially those that already put their lives back together and already done all their time, already been reinstated, thought they were fine. So that's what 1207 is trying to do. And what I did in my testimony to help you is saying, if the conditions were prior to 9995, here are the categories and things that will happen to folks. Like I said, if you were in prison, okay, you're still going to have 8 years at the end. If you'd already got your privileges back, you're going to keep your privileges. Okay, forget that new revocation. That's not going to happen. That's going to go away. If you were out of prison but still on parole or post-prison supervision or probation, you will do 8 years, but it will start from your original revocation, not this new one, but we'll go back. Let's say it was, I don't know, 1993, okay? Back when your original revocation was, you got out of prison, and you were out of prison on 995, it will add, instead of being a 5-year revocation from 93, it will be an 8-year revocation from 93, okay? And then the other major shift that 1207 does is it takes assault in the second, third, and fourth degree, and instead of being a revocation, makes it a suspension, which then makes you eligible for a hardship permit with certain wait times waiting for the hardship permit. A hardship permit is what somebody uses to drive to and from work. Okay, you are suspended. You're given a sort of a probationary license to use to get to and from work on certain times, certain dates. And if you're caught driving outside of that time or route, then you are driving while suspended because you are driving off outside of your probationary license. This is something you've provided in law for quite some time. So it's doing those things. And then what the amendments are about. So it's trying to go back and fix that retroactivity piece of 3060 from the 95 session that hit a lot of people and that wasn't the original intent is what was discovered. So 1207 is trying to fix that, trying to put some sense to it, trying to still say you will notice it when you get out of prison. You won't have your license suspended while you're in prison because that doesn't mean anything to you. You didn't even notice the sanction probably. And then what the amendments are doing, A4, is some technical amendments that we need, like I said, inserting the words or right to apply, because you not only revoke a driver's license, you may be revoking someone's right to apply if they never had an Oregon license. You don't want them to just bebop into the field office at DMV and say, nanner, nanner, you can't touch me. You know, I didn't have a license, so I can get one. The sanctions are supposed to apply to both. And so that's mostly what those amendments are doing. They're technical amendments. And we have worked very closely with Steve Dole from Crime Victims United, who was the original proponent of Senate Bill 3060, and Steve's here. and Keith Meisenheimer, a Multnomah County DA, who's very, very familiar with these cases, and the Attorney General's office to try to make this bill the correction that people would wanted it to be. And that's what I'd say.
Okay.
Any questions on the bill or the A4 amendment for Taylor? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll call Steve Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Dole. To tell you the truth, Kelly did a great job. I don't have much to add to this. I will say this, that it does, I think she made this clear, but I want to refocus on the fact that it does take second, third, and fourth degree assaults, particularly the second and third degree, out of the eight-year area. Because they just weren't proportional to the crime that was committed. They weren't proportional to the rest of the revocations. The homicide stays 8 years. First-degree assault stays 8 years because in first-degree assaults you normally have some type of a permanent either physical or mental damage to the victim. In second and third degrees, the person who is revoked now actually gets, if you will, a better deal than they did in the original law, because in the original law, where it was a 5 years revocation, they now get a 8 year suspension on second degree, but they can, as she said, can get their license back in 4 years. And on third degree, they get a 5 year suspension where they can get their license back in 2 years under these hardship permits. And on the misdemeanor, fourth degree assault, it's a 1 year, which it always was, except they can get their hardship permit back in 6 months. So I think we provide some opportunity there for the offender to rehabilitate. But I appreciate your hearing this bill, and I appreciate your vote, your yes vote on this bill with the aforementioned amendments. I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Dole?
Thank you. Can you just describe what drove the little bit of legislative history about 3060, about what that law was about?
Well, it came about, as most of you know, my daughter was murdered with the use of a motor vehicle. And what we found out during the course of that was the fact that we asked, well, what happens to somebody's license when they use a motor vehicle as a weapon, turn it into a weapon? And it was explained that they get a 5 year revocation. Well, in most cases, if you get a 5 year revocation for murder or manslaughter, in actuality, you could reapply for your driver's license while you're still in prison because you'd be doing your term. And many people agreed with the fact that that should be a point of public safety, a point of just like you take away a person's right to bear an arm, if you will, when they commit a felony offense, that they should have their right revoked for a certain amount of years. So that's where the bill actually developed from historically, and that's where the idea came from to revoke the license from the time that they're released, if in fact they are doing prison time. Now, for some of these offenses, like third-degree assaults and fourth-degree assaults, of course, there's many times where they won't be doing a prison term, so it'll be from the time of conviction.
One last question.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Obviously, that was 4 years ago. Did this problem only become more apparent?
Well,
years or so?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it was brought to my attention actually last summer, and that's when I originally wanted to bring this bill in front of the legislature, because I knew it needed a fix, particularly around third-degree assaults, because there was a real disproportionality with third-degree assaults. When the session started, I realized that there were more problems around the retroactivity clause and also around the second and second degree assaults, and that's when we went in and further changed the bill to address those problems.
Great.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Mr. Gardner, I see your name on the sign-up sheet here. You have something you'd like to add? Come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General. I apologize for not having a suit coat on. I wasn't planning on testifying today, but I was asked to come over, and so that's why I don't have it. We're here to support Senate Bill 1207 and the amendments that have been presented to you. Our interest is a financial one. We have a number of cases that are being litigated under the present law, and if these, if this bill is passed with these amendments, that will moot out some of the cases, and we will save the state some money. From a policy point of view, I think it's probably justified as well, and so I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
I just have a technical question, maybe a committee staff. We've got a fiscal of 64,200. Does this need to go to Ways and Means, or?
Yes, please. Mr. Chair and members, the $64,000 would be if DMV just had to do one set of programming changes. They anticipate a number of things that can be fit into that 64, but I kind of put that on any measure that requires programming changes. But Kelly's also here to answer that.
Do some clarification, Mr. Gordon.
So it's a combined of several bills. So this actually doesn't have a full 64, just on this particular one.
Yes, the fiscal statement should be noted that this cost will be shared by any other legislation that changes suspension.
So is there other legislation?
Yeah.
I mean,
there's legislation that affects DUI and commissions, I believe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Hitter again. If this were the only bill that passed, it had to do with the suspension system, it would cost us $64,000. So we have to do that on the fiscal because you never know what else is going to pass.
Right.
I do believe there are other bills that have passed that have to do with suspension, so that would reduce the cost. But each fiscal has to stand on its own because you never know if it's going to get vetoed or if it's going to make it. Or that's the minimum amount that it would take to change the suspension program.
Okay. For the question? Thank you very much. Colleagues, we are in work session. Is there a motion on the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 1205? 1207, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment on Senate Bill 1205. Or 1207.
Thank you.
It was me doing it.
Okay, colleagues, there's a motion before us to move the A4 amendments into Senate Bill 1207. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 1207 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, colleagues, we have a motion to move Senate Bill 1207 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Dubar?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to point out to the committee that I do have had at least one constituent who was caught in this Catch-22 arrangement. I have worked with him and have told him that this bill is in the process, and I thank Mr. Dole for recognizing what happened with the 1995 bill and being willing to work with the, you know, I guess innocent is not the best word to use, but the unfortunate circumstances that for other people that happened and correct the problems for them.
For the discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Is there a volunteer for carrier?
Okay. Want, or someone, I didn't hear the testimony, but I'm aware of the bill and the issues. So. I'm happy to do it if you wish.
Okay, that's fine.
We had a house bill that went over that was different in concept, but same goal.
Right. We'll recommend Max to be the carrier, and that will close the work session on Senate Bill 1207. Senate Bill 558 is on our agenda today. I am anticipating, had anticipated we would have some information from the governor's office about what they may be agreeable to sign. We do not have that information yet, but Senator Kuzanski is getting that for us. We will be skipping over Senate Bill 558 today and come back to it as soon as we have that information. And we will go then to Senate Bill 722.
Good film.
Session on Senateville 722, and we still have a sign-up sheet for this, don't we? There's some invited testimonies. You want to come forward,
Mr. Chairman?
And yes, Representative Devlin has some information for us also.
Mr. Chairman, I have some written testimony from Rich Peppers, who was here previously to testify. He's in the back. And he would just like his written testimony into the record. He still does not have a voice to actually deliver it. So if the committee administrator could just get the testimony here and distribute it to the members of the committee, that would be fine.
Okay, you wanted to visit with some about opt-out provision within the bill, and please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Ramig, and I'm with the firm of Lindsay Hart Neyland Weigler, and I'm testifying today on behalf of our client, the Variable Annuity Life Insurance Company, which is one of the major providers of alternative retirement plans nationwide. And in specific terms, I want to talk about the opt-out provisions of Senate Bill 722A. Appearing with me today is Dennis Monahan of Aon Consulting, which is one of the largest employee benefits consulting firms in the world. Mr. Monahan is with local jurisdictions throughout Oregon on retirement plans and has particular expertise in some of the actuarial issues that have been raised with regard to the opt-out provisions. I want to just summarize the written statement I've given to you, and which really responds to a number of concerns that have been raised related to the opt-out provisions. And I guess in doing that, I'd like to state again that I'm testifying on behalf of a company with vast experience in alternative plans, and in that capacity, I'm not testifying on behalf of local governments, but rather from the standpoint of ensuring that there is an efficient interface between the PERS system and any other alternative plan that a local jurisdiction might adopt if the legislature indeed moves forward with that approach. So that's the focus of our comments today. One of the issues that was raised at the hearings earlier this week was the fact that in the existing opt-out language, if a local government were to opt out of PERS, they aren't specifically required to adopt an alternative plan. They could, in fact, have no plan for retirement. Now, that is an unlikely result in practice, given the competitive nature of the employment market and the need for cities to recruit and attract qualified employees. But I wanted the committee to be aware that the other alternative retirement plan legislation that has been adopted by the legislature in the 1995 session for OHSU and for the Oregon University System did in fact require that an entity that chose an alternative system of that nature have a qualified plan under the Internal Revenue Code in place as an alternative. So it's not something that's in the bill as presented to this committee, but it's something that would easily be drafted and something that there's precedent for in existing Oregon law. The second point I wanted to raise is at in my earlier testimony, I mentioned that the opt-out provisions in Senate Bill 722A would not have an adverse impact on PERS. And I know that's been a concern of the governors, and it might, and that's why Mr. Monahan is here for you today to explain in detail why opt-out provisions in this bill would not have an adverse impact on the existing PERS system. The third point I wanted to address relates to portability, which is one of the more important concepts in retirement plans as a general matter, and frankly one of the stickier wickets, because increasingly employees want portability of pensions, and retirement systems haven't evolved to make that a perfect transition in every case. And there are really three scenarios at play here. One is an employee who's, you know, working for a local jurisdiction who may want to go into the private sector or into the nonprofit sector. Under the existing PERS system, there's virtually no portability or complete portability of that benefit. They can take a portion of it, but not all of it, and that's generally very unattractive to employees. A second situation would be within jurisdictions of PERS, like moving from a city to a county, and one of the advantages of our existing system, because it's fairly uniform, is those transitions can happen with portability. So the question arose, what happens if a jurisdiction were to opt out of PERS, have a separate plan, and then an employee wanted to go back to the PERS system? And the reason I wanted to clarify that issue today is PERS itself has supported a bill in this session that allows for someone in a plan outside of PERS to roll their pension into PERS. That was done in the context of community college pension portability. So, again, it's an issue that is easily addressed through a minor amendment to the opt-out provisions. The last point I want to raise relates to the effect of opt-out provisions on retirement for police and firefighters. One was a concern that related to retirement age, that if you had been in one jurisdiction for a period and went to a jurisdiction that opted out, or vice versa, would you still be able to retire at the earlier ages allowed under the PERS system? Well, the opt-out provisions do not have any intent to override that, and again, could easily be handled through a clarifying amendment, as the benefit levels have already been addressed in subsection 7 of section 20 of the bill that requires any plan for a jurisdiction that opts out to provide benefits equal to or greater than those provided in the PERS system. A final point in that regard would involve jurisdictions that maybe don't want to go through the periodic calculation of whether the benefits they're providing to police and firefighters are equal to or greater than PERS. An easy amendment to the opt-out provisions would allow a jurisdiction otherwise wanting to opt out to simply leave police and fire in PERS, so they don't have to go through that process. So through a fairly easy set of adjustments to the opt-out provisions, all of the concerns that were raised earlier in the week can be addressed. And I'd add to that, what I hear in this whole bill is a desire on the part of local jurisdictions to really have a yardstick against which they can measure the value of the benefits they're getting from PERS, and to make a judgment weighing the attractiveness of those benefits to employees versus the cost to local jurisdictions and ultimately to taxpayers. And so I guess my hope would be that the committee could see a way to include the opt-out language, and if there's a desire to correct some of the concerns that have been raised in the hearing, I'd be happy to be available for whatever expertise we could provide to make sure that they're addressed in a way that does create an efficient interface with the existing PERS system. So those are my comments, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions, and Mr. Monahan can address the, you know, the actuarial issues related to the effect of any opt-out on the PERS system or their pooling rate.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing up these ideas for dealing with the concerns that have been expressed. What I'd encourage you to do is perhaps sit down with some of the folks who have expressed these particular concerns to see if you can come up with some specific amendment language. The way the concerns were expressed to me, certainly there was a concern about portability, and you've discussed that. There was a concern about weakening the provisions of PERS and there's always a policy issue as to whether you ought to have an opt-out at all, although I know the counter-argument is if you have an opt-out that's as good as or better requirement, then perhaps you put the pressure on PERS to be competitive too. So, I mean, there's a lot of arguments to be made, but have you had a chance to sit down with some of the folks who expressed concerns and see whether or not there's some language that you can come up with that would make them comfortable?
Mr. Chair and Representative Maddox, I have offered to meet with a number of the interested groups and remain willing to do so for that purpose.
I'd suggest, if I may, Mr. Chairman, that if you want to see an opt-out provision in here, you better sit down with those folks, because and I appreciate your willingness to do so, but some of them are here today, and I understand because we're talking about a couple of other things in this bill, it probably won't move today, but... And I say this with all courtesy and just and urging that you talk to those folks and perhaps start that conversation this afternoon.
I'd be delighted to do so. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the questions from the committee, Representative Devlin.
Thank you. To state the obvious and not state it in a negative fashion, but just to state the obvious, your interest in this obviously is that if jurisdictions opt out, it's opening up a market that you currently don't engage in that much. Would that be a correct statement?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, I'd say I have two interests and always try to have two interests in representing both my client and working with the legislature to develop good public policy. One, obviously, is my client would value a larger market where they have a substantial expertise in providing services. From my own personal standpoint, again, I mentioned a personal anecdote the other day. It's tragic for me to see situations where local jurisdictions are forced to very difficult decisions because there isn't a fair balance between benefits for employees and costs for employers. And I think interjecting an opt-out into the system is probably the surest way to engage some competition into what's presently a monopoly in retirement services, at least for most jurisdictions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Some of the products that would be ultimately offered to jurisdictions and ultimately their employees, in broad terms, how would they compare to the rate of return history of PERS?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, the plan put together in any jurisdiction obviously is a function of what that jurisdiction chooses to do through, you know, its own internal deliberations, I assume including collective bargaining with its employees. As far as the return on investment of providers of alternative plans relative to what PERS has experienced in recent years, I think they'd both be very outstanding in light of historic returns, if you will. I mean, everyone investing in the markets these days is having a very strong success.
Third question.
Yes, Mr. Devlin.
You addressed the issue of portability. How would that be interpreted for the individual, or how would that impact the individual employee should they go from one jurisdiction that's in PERS to another jurisdiction that has a plan that's occurred because of an opt-out? But it's not, let's say, it doesn't have the same benefits. It has somewhat less benefits levels than PERS, and then they try to go back to a PERS employer.
Sure. If I could, Representative Devlin, Mr. Monahan has even greater expertise in those issues than I would, and I don't want to put it in your lap, Dennis, but I think he could probably give you a more sophisticated answer even than I could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin. There are some issues involved in that. If a person was in PERS, if I'm understanding your example, and then would work there for at least, say, 5 years to become vested in PERS, and then were to transfer to a public agency that wasn't in PERS, and then later were to come back, the only question is, what is the impact of the benefit they've earned under that public sector employer who had opted out of PERS? Coming back into PERS, they haven't lost anything as long as they left their funds there and not asked for a withdrawal of their money match portion. and then that can be addressed in a couple of different ways. If PERS does not want to be involved in that process at all, it really is a major problem in my mind looking in the retirement issue, because you always have the option of...
Please announce your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You did introduce.
I'm Dennis Monahan, Aon Consulting. I'm sorry. The issue, an example you designed, sir, is really what happens to that piece that benefits the individual earned while at the public sector employer who was out of PERS. And that would be handled in one of two ways. First way, you can make this bill or have PERS address the issue to allow them to transfer money into PERS from that prior employer. A more common approach, one that is almost universally common in the private sector, is the individual simply has the option of leaving. If the amount is a certain size, they can leave it with the employer they're terminating from, or they can roll it over into an IRA, for example. So there's, in my mind, in the example that you drew, I don't really see an opportunity for anyone to lose anything. Now, I can talk about some ideas that you could consider if you want to have PERS essentially absorb those benefits, but I haven't given any thought to whether down the road this would present any additional funding problem. One idea that comes to mind, and this is just off the top of my head, and I don't want anyone from PERS here to faint at this idea, but, for example, you could allow them to take the money out of the middle employer, the second employer, and transfer that into, for example, the money match portion. Part of it would go into their piece. Part of it would go into the employer piece, for example. Now, there are some issues that have to be resolved, and I would want to start on that this afternoon. But my point is that it's not an insurmountable problem. There are different ways that you can handle it, either simply by having an individual handle it on their own, or by having PERS essentially integrate their portability procedures with the former employer who was not in PERS.
How would you address that example, that similar example that was brought up to us, I believe, yesterday, with concern? Let's say you have a firefighter that serves 10 years under a PERS system, then serves 10 years under a non-PERS system, then does another 5 years under PERS. She or he could technically retire at this time, but they wouldn't have 25 years under PERS.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If the 10 years wasn't commensurate with the 10 years that they would have had under PERS, they might not have a benefit equivalent to what the goals of PERS are for retirees.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. How would you address all those issues?
Well, again, this is Dennis Monahan, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin. One way of looking at it is that when these programs are introduced, for example, I work with the OHSU program, and I also work with the higher ed program. Our concern was that people not be led to believe that they have to choose this, or this is their only choice, which is the opt-out, or second, that they not be misled on the trade-offs that they are accepting. Now, in your example of a firefighter or a police officer who works 10 years at one in PERS at a city or a county, and then moves out of PERS and then decides to come back, you know, that person is making rational choices. When they move out of PERS, I don't think they're being tricked into thinking that they are losing something. If I had an employer who was pulling out of PERS, if they had this opt-out, my recommendation would be that they, if it's allowed, that they keep their uniforms, officers, fire, police, and so on, keep them in PERS, because it really isn't worth the headache to do the people who are better than. I don't think you gain anything by being out of PERS. I don't want to punt the issue back and say, let's just not let it happen. My point is, you know, my point is that the individual who made the decision to leave the firefighters in PERS and move to an institution, an employer who was not out of PERS and then came back, You know, I don't believe the system is being structured against them. I mean, they're making rational decisions. Nothing is being. They're not being prevented, not being forced to make those choices. And so I'm not sure it should be on her shoulders to try and make them whole, or on the employer that they went to, the second employer. I'm not sure that they should be required to make them whole for a latter choice. If you're concerned about that, then allowing local governments to keep their uniformed officers or fire and police in PERS as a choice, I think would be a good solution, a good option to give the local employers. And I think it's kind of a rambling discussion. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, I might give an example of in going away from police and firemen, including it an example also. The average duration for a city manager in this state is about 3 to 5 years with an employer. For a fire chief, it's not with a department that's bringing its own people up from the bottom up. I shouldn't say bottom, but... you know, a lot of the smaller fire departments, an average duration for a chief is 4 to 5 years. They move all over the place. There are a lot of public agencies like that, and part of recruiting qualified people for replacement is what benefits package you offer. And if you offer something that's significantly less than PERS and they happen to have been a PERS employee before, they're less likely to take your position.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, can I speak to that issue briefly?
Just briefly.
I think there may be a concern or an implication that an alternative plan would be less generous. Yes, my comment would be is probably it will be different. And for someone, a jurisdiction that opts out, an example you gave of somebody who's been in PERS and out of PERS and back in PERS, it's not necessarily the case. In fact, it may be exactly the opposite, that they would be less well off than if they had been in PERS that entire time. In fact, what's more likely to be the case is that they'll have substantially more options at the end of that period on how they take their retirement, what the benefit calculations are, and a whole slew of issues than they have under the PERS system. So I think the implication that someone could end up worse off isn't the case. And I think beyond that, as I've already noted in the bill, there's a provision that would require any alternative plan adopted by a city or county that opts out to provide a benefit level equal to or greater than that being offered by PERS. So I don't think that concern, while I understand hypothetically it may be a concern, is a concern in real life.
Thank you. Did you have a separate bill in the Senate that addressed the opt-out issue, or is this something that just came up as part of the discussion on Senate Bill 722?
This came up in the context of Senate Bill 722, Representative Mannix, but we have worked with the legislature in prior sessions on alternative plans and requirements for those.
Well, it seems to me that the challenge that you face is that whether or not PERS has any warts, it's our PERS, and it's a system that we've had for a long time and we've developed a certain comfort level. It's one thing to supplement our PERS. It's another thing to provide alternatives. I would imagine a desire to have some regulatory authority then to make sure that any jurisdiction that's opting out was providing an alternative that, A, was portable enough, B, could be plugged in easily enough, C, provided the same level of benefits or better, D, provided the same level of security or better. Then I start saying, well, also you'd want to have some ease of understanding it. As you see, as these issues arise, it gets pretty complicated. And if this were Nike or IBM and we were talking about the corporate structure, you'd probably hear some resistance from the board of directors to having every one of their divisions have an opportunity for optional retirement plans, especially if they wanted to have transferability of employees. I'm talking about this a bit because I'm sort of thinking this through. When I look at the workers' comp system, we allowed jurisdictions to opt out of coverage by SAFE, but that was simply a straightforward insurance carrier. The coverage stayed the same. The benefits stayed the same. The risks stayed the same. Here, when we talk about opting out, all those things could be different, and there is a certain
significant amount of nervousness. Now, we're apparently going to be hearing a little bit about a deferred, possible deferred tier and third tier and some interim study on that. While we're doing that, should we be looking at a careful interface for any possible opt-outs to protect from all these things? Or do we have, it doesn't sound like we've got a package here that we could just say, hey, we're going to, we've got the model coming off the assembly line and we're ready to roll on it. That was a more of a commentary, but I invite you to respond.
Yeah, I would, Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, I would like to comment. I think, whenever there's change, there's a lot of concern over what implications might be, and I'd just give a couple of examples by way of reference. One is the bill that authorized alternative retirement plans for the Oregon Health Sciences University was one or two sentences. And then OHSU relied on experts like Mr. Monahan to help them structure a plan that was, worked for their employees, and there was a consistent interface, an efficient interface with PERS. And as a result, a large number of new employees hired by OHSU are choosing the alternative plan relative to PERS. The Oregon State University Systems Plan was much more complex, much more detailed, but that's the type of approach that they wanted to pursue. One of the advantages of this bill is that any decision to opt out, because it's being made by a local government that, just like the legislature, meets in public and has the opportunity for all manner of input on that decision, these are the sorts of issues that are addressed, and they're addressed to the liking of the local jurisdiction doing them. So one of the things that is interesting for me in this debate is a lot of these issues are really alternative plan issues that need to be worked out between the local government and the provider of the plan with expert assistance from people like Mr. Monahan. And there are things that, from the standpoint of the legislature, I think they're good to address, but I don't think we'll probably ever get to the level of detail, nor would we want to, because each jurisdiction is different and will have different goals in establishing that plan. So I would offer that just as a response to say that our experience in Oregon has been with two major employers. They had very different goals, very different levels of specificity, but both plans seem to be working very well at this point.
Mr. Chairman, one follow-up.
For two minutes.
So we all like to look at these things from our own perspective because it helps us understand things. But going back to the 70s, I'm someone who's been employed by the judicial branch, by the Attorney General's office, then I was employed by the Workers' Compensation Board, and now I've been employed by the people as a legislator, and that's the legislative branch. So I've been in three branches of government and I think four different agencies all that time connecting up with the PERS system. So there's some familiarity with that linkage. Now, what if I had been linking up each time with a different retirement system, which I have others out there for in the private sector because of other things I've done, but are you proposing to have some way that all of that gets pulled together when someone's in their 60s and looking to retirement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, that's an excellent question, and frankly, that is the experience of most people either in the public sector or the nonprofit sector. Who are increasingly changing jobs, that's why portability is such an issue, is at the end of your employment, you want to be able to have a benefit package that makes sense. And that's why, frankly, I'm appearing today and offering to work with the interested parties and mentioning that while these are issues, they're issues that have been dealt with successfully in this state and in other jurisdictions, and it's in the interest not only of my client, but of everyone concerned to make sure that they are dealt with. So people end up, one, understanding their benefits and having an ease of administration of their retirement so that everybody, comes out ahead. So I think it's a valid concern, but it's one that everyone shares an interest in addressing and is being addressed very successfully.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sinbad.
Thank you. I didn't hear a lot of the testimony on Wednesday from you, so I may go over some ground that you covered. A couple of things. One, could you just describe, and maybe this is to your guest here, what is the product that Valix sells? What is it that you're the alternative? that would be available to get an opt-out.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, the bill as drafted does not specify any particular kind of product, and there are multiple types of retirement plans. They fall into two general types. One is a defined benefit plan, which HERS would be a very good example of that, that guarantees a certain benefit for employees upon retirement. Another very common alternative is known as a defined contribution plan. That's very an example that's familiar to most of us of that type of plan is like a 401k plan, where a person's retirement is a function of contributions into that retirement plan plus investment earnings over a period of time. Those are, you know, I'm speaking in general terms, are the types of plans available on the market, and Mr. Monahan has expertise in defined benefit plans. My client specializes more in defined contribution plans, and in this bill, local governments wouldn't be constrained one way or the other as to which type of plan they could implement.
Now, obviously, you're aware, as I believe Alec has been a participant in the defined benefit of the defined, the 457 plan that we offer here. So, I mean, and that's actually available to local government. So, I guess if you were offering another plan, would it be an enhancement to what the state already has under 457, or are you suggesting something else?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Edwards, the opt-out provisions of Senate Bill 722 deal with an alternative plan to PERS for basic retirement. It wouldn't address the 457 type of plans you've made reference to.
Two more questions. One of the things I guess I'm still a little unclear, and again, I didn't hear a lot of the testimony both from PERS and from you about why, what's the rationale, why you feel that an opt-out wouldn't hurt the current PERS system? What specifically?
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, different people probably would have different goals, and I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but the concern that I've heard consistently in the context of Senate Bill 722 and the PERS reform measures introduced in this legislature was a desire on the part of cities and counties who felt, I think PERS has acknowledged that they have operated the system historically for the benefit of employees as opposed to balancing that against the needs of employers and taxpayers, and that therefore an opt-out was really a way of injecting some sort of competition into the retirement services market. So if the city felt like they were getting an unfair deal from PERS, they had an option, where today they, if they've elected to be a part of the PERS system, they don't really have that option. So that would be one set of concerns. But as I just mentioned to you, there are different types of retirement plans, and defined contribution plans offer different things than defined benefit plans. For example, portability is greatly enhanced with a defined contribution plan. The way that you can take your retirement is enhanced in a defined contribution plan. For example, you own that benefit, and you can pass it through to your heirs as an estate planning mechanism. So different people are motivated by different things in, as they look at types of retirement services. And so I think when you say, what is this bill about, I think the main thing driving the opt-out provisions is a desire on the part of local governments to get control and certainty over what their retirement funding expense will be. That's the number one driving force in this legislation. But, if, for example, in the context of the alternative plans for OHSU or for the university system, that wasn't a major consideration. A major consideration at that time was enhancing portability and creating greater flexibility for the members of those institutions with their retirement, recognizing that they were a pretty mobile professional class.
One last thing, and maybe more of a statement. The whole debate over whether we offer a defined benefit program and versus that's what PERS is, or defined contribution, which is really more what the private sector has moved towards or has,
I mean, that's a debate that's always worthy to have. I think I follow what Jim Mannix picked up. Person's been here a long time, and quite, in my opinion, served the state very well, and its citizens. Now, I would suggest that, you know, competition may be an opportunity, but I'm not convinced yet that the system warrants that confusing competition right now would be in the long-term interest, whether it's the employer or the employee. Because I always, I guess from my perspective, I tend to look at who's the beneficiary, and that's where you got to start. What are we trying, as a policy, you have a benefit program for a certain reason, and that is to offer your employees some retirement. And then from that, I mean, the issue of cost backs up into the employer side of it. And I guess I'm still not reading this hearing testimony and hearing any past, putting in an opt-out seems a pretty dramatic shock, potential shock to the system, but also more to what is it that the employees will ultimately get. Defined contributions have higher risks. You tend to ride that risk more. There may be a more, the portability issue may be more valid, but in the end, you also ride more risk with that typically, because you have to ride the investment. You have the investment decisions or may control that. You may not make the best decisions there, and in the end, you may have less. I mean, there's a, the first system, has done a very good job generally in providing a decent benefit to retirees. Maybe the years of late raise a question about how some of the local governments have handled managing their liabilities. I think that's one of the issues that's addressed in this bill. But I think if we're looking at it purely from a benefit point of view, I think that's what, in my mind, the main focus of what we're trying to do here today. Just more of a statement. If you want to comment on it, I'd be happy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Edwards, my only comment would be that I would hate to see the opt-out provisions viewed as somehow throwing out PERS or crashing PERS. That's not the purpose of the provisions. That's not the provisions of the purpose of an alternative plan. It's basically just a recognition that defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans, using those as examples, are different, and different people. One size doesn't fit all in retirement, just like it doesn't most things in life. And the goal of having an alternative is to allow local jurisdictions to look at the PERS system and then look at an alternative and see what makes the most sense for the employer from the standpoint of certainty of cost, and to the employee from the standpoint of a whole host of benefits that are available in the defined contribution plan. And I think there was testimony earlier this week that depending on how that calculus worked at any given time, a city may or may not decide to opt
in. Picking up on this, have you thought about the idea of saying, well, the alternative plan can be adopted by a jurisdiction if it's agreed to through collective bargaining as a start?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mannix, I have assumed that would be the nature of things, that for a local jurisdiction to impose something on their employees, in my judgment, would be probably a little heavy-handed and counterproductive. So I've always assumed that any alternative plan that a local government entered into would be done through good faith negotiations with their employee unions.
And it might be fruitful then for you to have that conversation with some other folks who are concerned, and that maybe there's some buffers that could be built up to allow the alternatives to go into the statute. Thank you.
If we have some standards, some work around, I think that would be helpful. Because personally, I am sympathetic towards, philosophically at least, of having some kind of an opt-out provision. Because it would serve as a yardstick whereby to measure the performance of PERS and keep the system on.
Well, Mr. Chair, what's your blessing? I'd be delighted to meet with the affected groups and try to have something to you know later Monday morning.
Thank you. And we need to move fairly quickly.
if we could be happy to hear the results of that discussion. Also, Mr. Monahan, did you want to comment any on the Tier 3, Tier 2, Tier 3 issues?
So there was one issue regarding the was raised regarding the necessity of a Tier 3. There were some comments that the Tier 2 arrangements adopted a few years ago solved all the potential funding problems under PERS. And I think if you look at where some of the funding problems of PERS have occurred, and problems only in the sense of challenges or things you need to be aware of, not caused by anyone, just the nature of the defined benefit plan, and look at how the Tier 2 is designed, I think you can see that not every problem has been solved or not every challenge has been eliminated. So, for example, look at some of the differences in Tier 2 versus Tier 1. One of the issues is that the unused sick leave or unused vacation cannot be rolled into your final pay salary calculation under Formula 1. I think that's my memory of one of the differences. The second is that the 8%, currently 8% guarantee under the fixed account is no longer there. They just have the variable, essentially the variable accounts. And the second change was moving the age of retirement, I think, from 58 to 60. Well, some of the issues that have caused problems and have caused some of this, some of the things we're talking about now are really still in Tier 2. For example, the money match. The only difference really is that there's no longer an option to take the 8% guaranteed account. You still have the money match problem there, which is still going to be driving a lot of the additional funding requirements unless the market tanks and people have end up having a better benefit under the formula. Not likely, but it could happen. The COLA, the 2% COLA, I think that's still part of Tier 2. That has to be funded in addition to the employer matching the employee's money match piece. So that's still an issue that has to be focused on. So some of the things that are causing the stress or the concern about PERS, the unfunded liability, are still in the Tier 2 system. The only changes we made have not really helped at all, and that is the 8% guarantee in the guaranteed account, current 8%, is no longer in the Tier 2. Because the market has done so well since Tier 2 was introduced, it really has had no impact on the benefit costs under Tier 2. As I see it, and I haven't looked at all the actuarial calculations versus Tier 1 and Tier 2, for example, but as I see it, the major difference is simply moving the age from 58 to 60. And that has helped bring the cost down, but it's not solved all the challenges the curve will be seeing in the future.
Have you seen the Tier 3 language in the bill?
I've looked at the Tier 3 language only briefly because I wanted to get through it quickly to get through the local government opt-out, which is what I was hired to look at and to comment on. As I see it, the advantage of the Tier 3 is, and correct me if I'm mistaken, the advantage of Tier 3 is it just focuses on one benefit form, the 1% plus annuity. And as I see it, that probably eliminates one of the potential challenges going forward that PERS and local governments and state agencies and other institutions involved in PERS will have to be focusing on. One of the challenges of a plan like PERS is very well, it offers the best of both worlds. It's from that standpoint, from the participant standpoint, it's a very well-designed plan, a very good plan in the sense of focusing on retirement benefits. But it does present a challenge to keep an eye on all the different options, all the different benefit structures, so that you can correctly fund for things sooner rather than later. An example is, obviously, the problems that cropped up a year ago with the funding levels and the identification of unfunded liabilities. Now, going forward, I don't see where you necessarily eliminate any of those possibilities by simply looking at Tier 2 versus Tier 1. Tier 3 does add less of a challenge, I believe, in keeping the plan perhaps better funded in a sense of not having being subject to these unexpected occurrences of additional unfunded liability like we have now or having now to deal with. And that's because it focuses primarily on one benefit structure, which is the annuity, the 1% plus the annuity. Is that answer the question, or is it too theoretical?
The base of comparison, I think. Any questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Thank you. We'll hear back from you then Monday
morning.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if somebody from PERS or representing PERS could come up and talk, just follow up to that conversation we just had, and presentation about what may or may not be the implications of some of these policy decisions.
Introduce yourself to the record and jump into it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Fred McDonald, Director of PERS, and Mark Johnson, our actuary from Milliman & Robertson. Did you have questions, Representative Ebert, that you wanted to direct to us, or
well, do you have any
charge on our observation?
Yeah.
Well, as you may have noticed, Mr. Johnson just arrived a few moments ago. I would offer a few brief observations on the testimony that we've just heard. From the standpoint of a difference between what OHSU and higher ed had in their optional retirement plan and a local government opt-out, I think the differences are significant in that when the OHSU and higher ed opt-out provisions were approved by the legislature, they were primarily, the objective was for faculty and administrative people who come in from out of state, help their recruiting, and other individuals would have their choice. They would have their choice, those individuals as well, as to whether they participate in PERS or don't participate in PERS. And certainly the employees presently that at the time the opt-out provisions were, the optional retirement plan were adopted, had a choice to either stay in PERS or go to the optional retirement plan. And predictably, what occurred is that the people who had been in PERS for a long time stayed in PERS. That's what you would expect. People that come and go would be more apt to go to the optional retirement plan, especially people that were younger. And this is why the actuary indicates that here's where the actuarial consideration comes to play, is that if the younger folks opt out of PERS, then the employer is left with the older, more expensive folks. And I don't think that's something that any actuary would refute. Also, there's a smaller payroll that would be in PERS to spread that liability over if people opt out. So that's one observation on the difference between the local government opt-out. If a local government opts out, that means that all new present employees would not be able to go into PERS, period.
Is that sort of analogous to the problem with Social Security in a lot of ways? And then people with lower payroll, obviously younger folks are supporting a larger number of people who are actually getting Social Security benefits.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, Mark Johnson, Hillman and Robertson. It's analogous in the sense that you'd have an aging workforce trying to fund the liabilities of a group that's very close to retirement or at retirement. We have testified not only to the Senate, I think we said the same thing yesterday, and certainly we've discussed this at great length with the retirement board. The particular type of opt-out in this bill is not as onerous to the employers to stay as the type that OHSU has, where current employees can leave the system. We have looked across the country, and every state that has had the type of opt-out that OHSU has had has recognized that have studied it, has recognized that there's a cost. And, we've looked at studies, including Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, Wyoming, Ohio, and Florida. And every time it was studied, the employer cost for the employees that stayed in the retirement system was higher. Now, the reason is there's no new blood coming in. And when you're funding a defined benefit type of program, if you look at different groups of people, you say, well, a young person is cheap. in relation to retirement costs. If you hire somebody very young, there's a higher chance the person is going to terminate, never make it to retirement, but the employer is funding this level percentage of pay on that employee as well. So to the extent that we lose new blood, young blood coming in to PERS, the employer contribution rate will tend to creep up. Now, we've also made it clear to the retirement board that for local agencies, when they are rated on their own, like they are now, this doesn't pose a problem. They're going to pay for it, and they're not. The problem the board is trying to deal with is trying to avoid one employer paying for the liabilities of another employer. So to the extent that they're all rated the same, that won't happen. But once we pool, the calculation becomes much more complex. And as I said yesterday, it can be done, but it's certainly not as clear that that employer is paying for its own liabilities. For example, let's say a state agency right now, where all state agencies are pooled. One state, let's say PERS, wants to opt out of PERS. How are we going to tell what liabilities are associated with just the PERS that's been paying the same state rate as everybody else? We don't know. Perhaps they've hired everybody at age 45 instead of age 25. Perhaps they have a much higher female population in the state. So maybe their cost, if they had been rated by themselves, should have been much higher. So by them leaving employees in the system then who are more expensive, they're shifting a burden, if you will, to other employers. Again, the provision that's in the bill now is not as onerous as the OHSU, and as long as we're not pooled, it's pretty clear that each employer is going to pay their own way. And again, if we pool, we mentioned yesterday there'll be administrative hearings, and we'll make every attempt, if the bill passes like it is, to make sure that those employers that opt out are going to pay for their liabilities.
I did have a question that doesn't relate specifically to our earlier testimony about opting out, but it relates to some of the information I asked from Mr. McDonald, that he was kind enough to get to me in a very quick period of time. The rates that are quoted in there, do they include some assumptions about for each employer paying their unfunded liability?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, those rates do include the 30-year amortization of their unfunded liabilities. So there's a part of that percentage that's to pay that unfunded liability.
Mr. Chairman, I can follow up with just a couple lines of questioning. If you allow them to bond some of their unfunded liability, then their overall rate would come potentially down. If you allow them to pool, you're going to basically end up with what might be almost like a base rate for local government employers, then plus whatever rate they come up with to pay their bonded indebtedness as part of their...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, although I said we'll have a public hearing, the board asked me to give them one scenario as to how we would pool. And the conclusion we came to was that at some point, and we've used December 31st, 97, the last valuation at first, every employer would be responsible for its own unfunded actuarial liability at that point in time. So you're absolutely correct. There's a base rate, which would be pooled. And then on top of that, each employer would have a different rate. In fact, some employers, if you look far enough down the list we gave you yesterday, there are some local agencies with a surplus. And, in fact, they would, under a pooled scenario, they would wind up paying the base rate less a 30-year amortization. And there are actually 22 employers that have such a large surplus. Now, granted, they're all very, very small. Such a large surplus, they'd pay no contribution at all.
Mr. Chairman, final follow-up. Is it assumed, this is just a broad question, if you allowed them to bond their liability, we're talking basically about this. The state would be entering into issue bonds. They would be paying the state banker. I got the treasury, but I just can't imagine 200 or 300 governmental entities out there each going out to bond their own individual, or would that be done through PERS?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, it's not that one. That would be done through Treasury. CURS really is not involved in that. And, but I would defer to Treasury for the real answer to that question.
Well, when the bill comes in.
Local jurisdiction by local jurisdiction, would it be done individually, would it not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem I would see is anytime she issued bonds, there's a cost in issuance of the bonds. It would make sense to aggregate them together under some entity.
That's my understanding of the design here, is that they're gathering together, and those who sign up will be involved in the bond issue.
Okay. We're getting it. Yes, from the back of the room. Okay. The treasurer. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have one other very quick observation in response to Representative Edwards, if you'd like me to address that. And that is, with regard to portability, I mentioned the other day that is something that we all try to achieve. That's good. I would just add that with respect to portability amongst our local government employers, that probably out-of-state portability is not as big an issue as in-state portability. We find more local government personnel moving from one county to a city or to a state as opposed to going to counties and cities or other private employers outside of the state of Oregon. That just seems to be the pattern that's followed with folks who work for local governments, is that by and large they stay in the state. Mm-hmm. So portability within PERS, I would think, would be an important part of their overall benefit structure. And probably part of the reason they choose to go into local government in the beginning.
Well, Mr. Chairman, after the last legislative session, the board asked me to come to one of their work sessions and explain the whole issue of portability. And as we viewed it, because the board agreed, the PERS does not have, at the current time, the facilities to take monies from another system and just park them in PERS. Now, there is a bill that would allow PERS to do that, just a holding place where employees can bring money from another system or the private and just have it there invested by the Oregon Investment Council. That would solve the portability coming in. The portability going out, first of all, is a five-year vesting rule, which is very common not only in other public systems but in the private sector as well. So there's some accelerated vesting in other defined contribution programs. But basically, the portability going out, if you think of PERS as a mutual fund, in a sense, that if I've got 5 years of service and I leave to go somewhere else, I leave my member account balance in PERS, I know that what I'm going to get eventually is no less than twice that with cost of living. And the money is invested by the Oregon Investment Council. So to the extent that I want to move my money for an investment reason, what we're saying is PERS is perfectly portable for people going out if they're willing to accept the Oregon Investment Council as their investment advisor. And for that reason, the PERS board, who was very interested in portability 2 years ago, has the only request that they made of the legislature is to allow portability coming in. But they feel that for portability going out, double the account balance invested with the Oregon Investment Council, and then with 2% cost of living after retirement, that's a pretty good situation. All a member has to do is elect not to take their money.
I think that question was asked the other day. You just described, and it is, I think, fair to look at the PERS system as a mutual fund in a lot of ways. I mean, it's basically shaped that way. The investments are. Would you say then that the rate of return on the PERS is as competitive as any private?
Well, I'm not the expert on that. I mean, Representative Edwards, any individual could pick, you know, lots of different varieties of mutual funds with a lot of risk and high potential for return as well as lower. PERS is the regular account, as you're probably aware, is a balanced portfolio, roughly 65% in equities and 35% in fixed income. So, I mean, an individual would have to buy into a balanced portfolio rather than 100% equities. But I would leave it to the Treasury staff to compare investment council returns with the rest of the world.
But I was just following up on your argument that it should, if a person leaves after being vested, in essence, by just leaving, by not the portability, the issue of
whether they could take the money and do something else. And you're saying by keeping it in after your investment, that in essence you're still going to see something. And that was my follow-on, was that the investment by OIC and the managers is as competitive, quite frankly, as you went out and you obviously have to define what kind of investment you're making, but in essence you still are going to have a pretty decent return.
Right, and don't forget the employer-funded cost of living. So really, even it doesn't have to be as competitive as another mutual fund, because there's a 2% cost of living once a person retires. So in order to fund that, you know, obviously it depends on how old you are when you retire, but roughly it's worth about 25% of the total. Getting a 2% increase after you retire is worth about 25% of the value at the time you retire. It's the age that most first people retire. So you have to take your account out, invest it in such a way that it grew to be 25% higher than PERS account in order to stay even. So even comparing investment accounts with mutual funds, I think you also need to factor in the employer-funded cost of living as well.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, over the years, the track record of the Investment Council has been very good. Doesn't mean that there aren't some that have beaten it, but it's been excellent.
One last thing. I mean, the issue of portability is an interesting one, although I would suggest I've never heard from constituents under PERS that's saying that's a problem if they want to leave it. I mean, I'm not sure where that concern is. I mean, I could see, again, from an employee point of view, maybe from an employer, again, the opt-out really is from an employer point of view, quite frankly, and a cost, if you want to make that argument.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Yes, sir.
We will close your work session on Senate Bill 1722. Actually, I wanted to discuss a little bit with members of the committee of several options. We have been discussing perhaps we haven't adjourned yet. A delayed implementation of Tier 3. I know that there is still some discomfort among some members of the committee with the whole Tier 3 and the opt-out provision entirely. But we will see some standards back, I hope, that could be put around the opt-out, and then some discussion of a delayed implementation of Tier 3, sending an interim study and analysis of how the unfunded liabilities accumulated and some other issues around that.
Mr. Chairman, but they can speak for themselves, but speaking for the three Democratic members on the committee, I think their preference would be to do the best, and we're willing to go with strong language for a study on the issue of opting out and on the issue of the third tier, and actually even if there are other issues that people as a whole believe should be brought into the study. I'm not saying, I don't know what the balance is on the committee on those issues, but I think we'd have a hard time approaching something that wouldn't require a further legislative action to put something into effect. A delayed implementation of a third tier is still implement.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they can speak for
it's very correct. I mean, I think part of the reason for the delayed implementation that you're, in the example you're giving, is that we don't know the full ramifications, and I'd rather see the study done to know the ramifications before any implementation takes place or later otherwise. And as far as the opt-out, I'm just not fully convinced on that one either, and I think that, you know, study that needs to be done as well.
Mr. Chairman, sure, if I might comment. How I look at this, too, is we just added a second tier, I believe, about 4 years ago. We're trying to make a system that will work for both employers and employees for the foreseeable future. I mean, we should probably keep thinking in 30 and 50-year increments. So if it takes us another year or two to decide whether we need to make additional changes, I don't think that should be a big problem. We're making some very good course corrections right now if we leave all the items in there except and don't do the opt-out at this point or the third tier. There's still plenty of good items in there that will benefit both employers and employees in the long term.
Well, I think regardless of how we handle the opt-out and the third tier, the other items in the bill, we need to allow them to move forward, as the dash 10 amendments would. But I'm not really philosophically, I think opt-out, maintaining some kind of opt-out standards around it may be a good idea. In the tier 3, we can just discuss that further about leaving the bill as it is or delaying implementation and sitting back and talking about it, how we would craft that, or whether we should...
2050 would be a good year for
2050. I appreciate your sentiment. I do. Thank you. We do have a couple things, and next week we'll start scheduling meeting time for 2 o'clock rather than 3. So it'll give us 4 hours if we go from 2 to 6. And we may start meeting in the morning time also. Do any of you have other meetings scheduled in the morning?
Yes, sir. I have some of what you need to add at 8 to 10.
8 to 10. Okay, and Representative Mannix has an afternoon sub generally. Wait a minute. And Representative Starr, I don't think he has a morning meeting.
He's gonna have a baby soon, I think.
He is. There'll be a morning meeting for him.
He's gonna be worthless.
Put the record show, right? It is a challenge. It is a challenge. I think most of us have been down that road already. And then on Monday evening, I am aware that the Democratic members have a double book, triple book, I think. Monday evening, we do have our committee party scheduled. It's not something I look forward to doing. It's just Republican members only. But
Mr. Chairman, I told the Democratic leader that I'm going to be doing a secret job. I'll go to the their thing first, then to the rules, then back to there.
Okay.
You'll have one, at least one, then.
Okay, we'll show up. Good. Well,
make it.
Okay. And I thought about pushing back half an hour start time, but as we cover it later, to accommodate you folks a little bit. I haven't done shopping for you yet, so maybe it's not with ours.
That's a double-edged sword.
Okay. Seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.
I want one of those dead animals on your wall.
Dead animals on the wall?